Hello, thanks for joining me for Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. Paul Barclay with you. Tonight, the revered 18th century thinker, orator, politician and campaigner, Edmund Burke. Guiding us through the highlights of his remarkable career will be the thoroughly entertaining Jesse Norman, MP for South Herefordshire and a rising star in the UK Conservative Party. In his just-published book, Edmund Burke, Philosopher, Politician, Prophet, Norman explains the life and times of Edmund Burke and explains why Burke's ideas continue to shape, inspire and inform contemporary political thought and debate. As you'll hear, underpinning Burke's approach to life and politics was his constant battle against the abuse of power, both in the public and private sphere. On Big Ideas, let's head to London and the RSA. This learned society began life in a Covent Garden coffee shop in 1754. 20 years later, during Burke's lifetime, it moved into its current premises just off the Strand in central London. Here now to discuss Edmund Burke, philosopher, politician, prophet, is Jesse Norman.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's a complete delight to have a chance to introduce Edmund Burke to you, or possibly reintroduce Edmund Burke to you tonight in this temple to Enlightenment values and the power of ideas. Burke, as you may know, was a political statesman of the first magnitude. He was also, I've hinted, a philosopher, indeed a prophet of a kind. He fought five great campaigns throughout his life. One for better treatment for the Irish and in particular Catholics in Ireland. Another for proper relationship between Great Britain and the American colonies and against what he saw as the oppressive misgovernment by London of the colonies. A third campaign to fight the encroaching power of the executive and of the monarch within politics. A fourth campaign to correct injustices of British rule through the East India Company in India. And finally, and this is, I think, the thing he's most much remembered for these days, against the French Revolution. But he was also not merely a campaigner, but a supreme orator and a prose stylist. Boswell said of Burke that watching Burke speak was like watching a man in an orchard, just pulling, as it were, apples and pears and pelting the administration completely freely. Such was the fertility and breadth of his imagination. And he's also, as I show in the book, but won't really have a chance to talk about today, really the first great framer of representative democracy in a kind of proto-modern sense, and of the proto-modern political party. And you may think he has a lot to answer for in that regard, but I want to persuade you, perhaps we can do this in the questions, that this is actually a rather profound and important thing to have done. But he also lived amidst a staggering cast of other characters. The end of the 18th century is one of the most amazing times, a kind of galaxy of talent around Burke. And so I want to pick the story up with him. So Burke is born in 1730 in Dublin. He goes to a hedge school, which is an open-air school outside the capital, and then to Trinity College, Dublin. He then makes his way, as every young man, and I'm afraid it generally was men at the time, worthy of his salt, did, to London. Of course, he tells his father that he's going to London in order to become a solicitor, to study, or indeed a barrister, to study at the Inns of Court. His father is a solicitor in Dublin. Unfortunately, this is true only for a period, but he very soon tires of the Middle Temple and decides to try and make his fortune as a writer and as a thinker. And this is an image of the underside, the underbelly of London in the year 1750. And it is, of course, Gin Lane by Hogarth. And it depicts a time when London was not merely the most exciting place in the world, the centre of a commercial empire that ranged from Bombay to Boston, but also a place where ideas were flourishing in a hitherto almost unimaginable way in this country. The British Museum, founded 1753, the novel starting to get going with Richardson and Defoe writing just before then. The fireworks music, these great occasions when Handel is able to gather thousands and thousands of people together for music and lights. The foundation of, a revolution is going on in the theatre at this time when these naturalistic styles of acting are being introduced by David Garrick. But there is also an underside. This is a place where one child in three survives into adulthood when there is an enormous, difficult, tough life for large numbers of people. And Hogarth vividly picks this up. This is a woman called Judith Dufour. Judith Dufour, in 1734, this slatternly lady letting her child fall off the side there she is a victim of the gin craze, which had broken out in the 1720s and 1730s. By the 1740s, the average consumption of gin in this country was 2 gallons a year per head. That's a non-trivial amount of gin. And Judith Dufour was famous, indeed infamous, in London, indeed England, because she, in 1734, had taken her child out of the parish workhouse into some wasteland, killed her, and then sold her petticoat to raise money to feed her gin habit. And such was the craze that it took five, I think, Acts of Parliament to bring it under control. So this is London, the underside, but also, let's not forget, the excitement of a city. And this Dubliner is making his way. And it's a city which is controlled by this man, or rather the followers of this man. And now, you don't know who this is, but everyone in 1740, when this caricature dates from, would have known who this is. This is, of course, Sir Robert Walpole. Now, Walpole had run British politics for 2 decades by 1742, and what this caricature, which is subtitled The Idol Worship or The Way to Preferment, what this caricature is doing is mocking Walpole's extraordinary grasp of patronage across both church and state. And so the message is, if you want to roll your wheel of fortune to great success, then this is what you have to do. And by the way, there's a carbuncle on the left cheek to remind you how painful the experience may be. And it does involve climbing on top of one another in the search for patronage and success. And everyone would have got the message. No need to show Walpole's face. And it's against that backdrop that Burke arrives in London. By 1760, you have George III on the throne, and the young king, the new king, who is George II's grandson, of course, and much younger, therefore, than would be expected, has come to power very much intending to put his own stamp on proceedings and to rein back these professional politicians. This is the so-called Whig supremacy. I'm caricaturing slightly, but broadly speaking. And so George III is determined to put his stamp on events, as he does, in some respects, with disastrous results. So Burke arrives in London. This is an 18th century image of a dinner party at Joshua Reynolds' house, and gives you some sense of what it must have been like at the time. These people were members of a famous club, cleverly entitled The Club, which met at the Turk's Head in Soho. Founder Joshua Reynolds, Burke's great friend, member number two, Samuel Johnson, member number three, Edmund Burke. And here we see a gathering at Reynolds' house which picks up the same figures. This is Charles Burney, the great musicologist. In the foreground, Johnson and Burke. Then you have Reynolds here and Boswell and the Corsican patriot Paolo Paoli and Goldsmith and Wharton. In other words, an extraordinary outpouring of talent, almost the like of which we will have never seen, indeed, before or since. When you think that Burke's friends included not merely people like Johnson, who left no branch of English literature untouched by his genius, people like Adam Smith, David Hume. I mean, this is just a staggering, staggering group of people. So it's a time when Burke is able to start to allow his own powers to flourish, and it is famously true that he and Johnson got on, but they got on with a certain undercurrent of competitiveness. Johnson said it's not surprising that Burke is the first man in the House of Commons because he would be the first man anywhere. But it's certainly true also that they had a slight undercurrent of competitiveness. And what's interesting is that, they dominate the conversation, but Johnson's style, very epigrammatic, very terse, Burke full of astonishing effusions of energy and imagery in his own speech. By 1765, Burke's got into Parliament. He arrives in early 1766. By that time, he's already, by an extraordinary stroke of luck, the secretary to the Prime Minister, the Marquess of Rockingham, because the merry-go-round under George III of administrations has turned several times at this point, and the Marquess has formed an administration, a short-lived administration, with his group, the Rockingham Whigs. This is a time where we do not have political parties in the modern sense. We have factions, and the Rockingham Whigs are a faction, and they've come to power. It's politically dominated by the aftermath of the Seven Years' War. So in 1756, we go to war with the French across, several continents. By 1763, we've comprehensively duffed them up in all areas. The church bells are worn out with ringing, in the words of Horace Walpole, but there's a gigantic bill to be paid. And that bill, on both sides, has an extraordinary long-term implication. In some respects, it actually ultimately leads to the French Revolution, which is caused in part by disastrous financial state of the French finances at that point, exchequer at that point. In Britain, it leads to the desire to impose duties and ultimately, therefore, the tea duty, and that's what creates the conditions of the Revolutionary War. Burke, of course, arrives in Parliament from a rotten borough, the borough of Wendover, but the good news was that he was saved any of the difficulties of a contested election. This is a time when treating is absolutely endemic, and I'm just going to give you a brief moment on treating, if I may. At the very least, voters in the 18th century expected to be lavishly wined and dined or treated by the different candidates. Treating remains an electoral offence today, but only if alcohol or meat are involved. It is an oddity of English law that vegetarians and teetotalers cannot be treated. In the 18th century, however, treating was endemic, and since elections often took weeks to conclude, the cost could be ruinous. In fighting for Chester in 1784, the Grosvenor family paid for 1,187 barrels of ale, 3,756 gallons of rum and brandy, and over 27,000 bottles of wine. The seat had 1,500 voters. So it's an interesting moment to be elected. So you've got the House of Commons, and Burke enters it and immediately starts to make his mark. And his oratory is truly extraordinary and instantly recognised as such. And the most there's a wonderful example of that, which is his speech on conciliation with the colonies, where he's desperately trying to argue in the last ditch that Britain must not go to war with the colonists, but must seek a more conciliatory approach. He says the proposition is peace. Not peace through the medium of war, not peace to be hunted through the labyrinth of intricate and endless negotiations, not peace to arise out of universal discord or to depend upon the juridical determination of perplexing questions. It is simple peace, sought in its natural course and in its ordinary haunts. It is peace sought in the spirit of peace. And his argument is a very simple one. It's not simply that Britain could never hope to win a war with a country 3,000 miles away. It isn't simply that the Americans are possessed of an extraordinary and independent spirit. It is that it would be an act of self-denial, almost of suicide, for the British to go to war against their own kindred people. And he demonstrates in the speech on conciliation this staggering ability he has to move from Olympian generalisation to the most perfect detail, as well as an astonishing flair for memorable expression. He says, "We cannot falsify the pedigree of this fierce people and persuade them that they are not sprung from a nation in whose veins the blood of freedom circulates. Your speech would betray you. An Englishman is the unfittest person on earth to argue another Englishman into slavery." Genuine simplicity of heart, this is going on somewhat, genuine simplicity of heart is a healing and cementing principle. Magnanimity in politics is not seldom the truest wisdom, and a great empire and little minds go ill together. So could Burke have averted the Revolutionary War if they'd followed his advice? Almost certainly not. It's just in the eve. But what we can say is that if they had understood the force of the argument that he had been putting earlier, then it's possible that the war could have been avoided and a more conciliatory and ultimately successful position achieved. It's also a time of great political turmoil. This is John Wilkes, another extraordinary figure from the era. John Wilkes, as you may recall, is a man with a positive genius for constitutionally effective mischief-making. He's the reason that you can read Hansard unfettered now, parliamentary proceedings subject to contempt of court before that, or contempt of parliament before that. He's the reason we don't have general warrants with no names on them. He's the reason that parliamentary privilege has been protected in the way it has been. He's an extraordinary man. Burke supped with a very long spoon with Wilkes. They were both very much on the, as it were, progressive side of the argument in the 1760s, but there was a fear that Wilkes was a little too strong medicine for any but the strongest substance. I might just quote, if I may, "In giving him a vicious squint and a prognathous jaw, nature had not been kind to John Wilkes. But he had overcome these impediments to procure himself a notorious reputation as a hell-raiser and philanderer. He boasted that it only took half an hour to talk away his face with a woman." In 1763, now an MP, Wilkes obtained an advance copy of the King's speech and denounced it and its presumed author, the Earl of Bute, in his radical and violently anti-Scottish weekly, The North Briton. He'd previously accused the Archbishop of Canterbury of buggery and called the Bishop of Gloucester's wife a professional prostitute. He had even suggested that Bute's influence extended to taking George III's mother as his mistress. This, however, was the final straw. And so, of course, they invade his house, they take his property, they do all these evil things, he countersues, he's elected triumphantly several times to Parliament, and these great things fall into place. Another snapshot of the era. But increasingly, in the 1770s, slightly, and then in the early 1780s, Burke is really preoccupied with one thing, and that is India. In India, the British have long had outposts in Madras and in Calcutta and in Bombay, and they've controlled increasingly the Coromandel coast down in the southeastern corner here. And then in the but they've done this as a trading matter, the East India Company. But in the 1730s and 40s, the running war with the French escalates, and then in 1756, they win the Battle of Plassey, which is really less a battle than a form of advanced bribery and deception. And the result of that is to open up a large amount of the hinterland, and in particular, in due course, Bengal, from which fountain of lucre results. And the result of that is twofold. One is that it sends a vast amount of young men, and I'm afraid it is always men, back to England as nabobs, that is to say, people, the modern Indian nouveau riche, if you like, who've returned back to India. They've managed to avoid dying of some exotic disease or malaria, and they've come back with staggering amounts that one could never hope to earn in one's own lifetime in India. And they've become a significant parliamentary force in their own right, and their support is rather crucial in the election in 1784, which brings Pitt, which defeats the Fox North Coalition and brings Pitt to power. And so by 1785, Burke has come to the view that this power must be restrained. And in Burke's view, And this is a constitutional topic of some widely shared at the time, but poorly implemented. All power, not merely public power, but private power, must be held accountable. And therefore, the power of the East India Company, and in thinking of the East India Company, I want you to think of Google and Microsoft and Apple and all these other firms combined to get some sense of its extraordinary influence. And therefore, he determines to do something about it. He's not in the government. He's only had 2 years in total in the government in a career of 30. So what to do? And the answer is to pull this man, Warren Hastings, the Governor General of India, back from India and to impeach him, to put him on trial in Westminster Hall in the most public possible way to demonstrate the long arm of English law and the accountability to which all power must be subjected. Now, Hastings, in many ways, was a rather great man, and it's extraordinary to explore the contrast. He'd done many bad things in India, but he was by no means a man without qualities, and it's quite interesting to see the parallelism in the scholarship and intellectual attainments of the two men. Nevertheless, Burke increasingly fixates on Hastings himself as a symbol of everything that has gone wrong in India. He calls him back and he brings him to Westminster Hall. The trial lasts for 7 years, and eventually Hastings is acquitted, as Burke knew and must have known he would be. He's got many friends in the Lords, and there's dirty work at the crossroads. And that is a late and crippling, in some respects, blow to Burke. But the principle of the public accountability of public and private, in particular private in this case, power, has been properly established. So let's then talk briefly about Burkean principles. All power must be legitimate and publicly accountable. We elect our MPs as representatives, not delegates. In 1774, Burke is elected as the Member of Parliament for Bristol. Bristol's a slave port, the number two city in the country at the time. It's a colossal achievement to become its MP. By 1780, he's decided not to stand again, because although he says in his great speech in 1774, where they're expecting him to doff the cap and thank them for electing him, he turns around and says, "I'm sorry," but he didn't actually even say "I'm sorry," but he says, "A Member of Parliament does not owe you. He does not follow authoritative instructions. He owes you just his judgment on your behalf." And Burke exercised his judgment, and they weren't very happy about it, because Burke's judgment was a very independent one, and when it included things like opposition to the death penalty for sodomy, or in particular the harshest penalties on people who didn't pay their debts, the merchants of Bristol didn't get very happy about that. And Burke, of course, actually, people don't realise this, was in the vanguard intellectually of the fight against slavery. Burke wrote a private memo in 1780 setting out in detail a way of regulating the slave trade prior to its abolition. This is 7 years before the abolition movement ever gets going in England at all. But he insists that MPs must be representatives and not delegates. And then these last two go together. Society is a trust which each generation must preserve. It is a compact between the generations, between the living, the dead, and those to be born. And as a trust, it must be held, as all power must be held, as a trust. And the job of the parliamentarian, the job of the political leader, is to safeguard, preserve, and enhance that trust, to preserve its lineaments, its features from the past, and to add to that a proper regard to present and future generations. And therefore, that leadership must be modest. It cannot put itself forward. It cannot advance its own interest over the interest of those in whose name it seeks to act. It cannot be subject to generational arrogance. There's a strong contrast with Jefferson here that we might explore in the questions, if you would like. So effective political leadership is modest and moderate in its actions and legitimates itself through its continued good work. And if I may just end, let me do so by reminding us all of his extraordinary prophetic genius, because in 1789, when on July the 14th the Bastille falls, the reaction in Britain is one of near universal rejoicing. All enlightened opinion regards it as the beginning of a transition to a constitutional monarchy. Wordsworth famously says that bliss was in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. And only Burke, and almost literally only Burke, and Burke immediately says, no, you don't understand. Everyone else is marinating themselves in self-congratulation. And Burke says, no, you don't understand. This is a disaster. This is going to lead to violence and bloodshed and terror and civil war and international war and ultimately to tyranny. And in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, published in 1790, he says this, and I will close on it. In the weakness of one kind of authority and in the fluctuation of all, the officers of an army will remain for some time mutinous and full of faction until some popular general who understands the art of conciliating the soldiery and who possesses the true spirit of command shall draw the eyes of all men upon himself. Armies will obey him on his personal account. There is no other way of securing military obedience in this state of things. But the moment in which that event shall happen, the person who really commands the army is your master, the master of your king, the master of your assembly, the master of your whole republic. The king would be dead already, but otherwise, this is a frighteningly exact description of the emergence of Napoleon Bonaparte. In 1793, that's 3 years after those words were written, the young general was starting to make a name for himself with the siege and seizure of Toulon. In 1799, he staged a coup d'etat, naming himself first consul and moving into the Tuileries. By 1804, he would be emperor of France. A year later, he would be master of continental Europe. Thank you very much indeed.
Jesse Norman, UK Conservative MP and author of a new book on Edmund Burke. On RN or online at abc.net.au/radionational. You're with Big Ideas. I'm Paul Barclay. Let's return to the RSA in London, where Jesse Norman is now joined in conversation by Allegra Stratton, the political editor for the current affairs programme Newsnight on BBC TV.
I think what struck me about your book was Burke is, to be very crude and trinket, is about established order. It's possibly sort of overly staid and not quite as poetic as you repeatedly. I mean, there's some beautiful things about the temper of the governed, I think, is a really lovely phrase about Burke emphasising all the time that it has to be about, firstly, that relationship between young, old, dead, to be born, but also what people will wear and then being wise and so on, where as in stomach rather than where as in where. But I suppose it's the classic sociology question, who's established order? So you have Mary Wollstonecraft getting very uppity, and there's lots of critique of Wollstonecraft that we could go into, the hyena in petticoats. She was a flawed individual herself, but was she not partially right that this is a worldview that if you are part of the Burkean accepted class, you're all right? And I say that accepting all of your five battles that he won and fought and sort of, but if you're part of that, if you're part of that, it's fine. But you know, what about 1832? Where would he have been on that? And where, it's too far ahead to talk about women in the vote, but that it was who's established order, and until he could sort of grapple with new groups coming through, he can't really be a thoroughly modern politician.
Well, of course, in many ways, Burke is a postmodern politician. He's critical to modern rather than a modern politician. No, of course, what's fascinating about Mary Wollstonecraft is that in some respects she's a very Burkean figure herself. I mean, she's fantastically eloquent. She writes this marvellously discursive criticism of Burke in a very similar kind of Burkean type way. She's enormously intelligent and fiercely kind of minded, fiercely independent. But I think her criticism's actually slightly missed the mark. As you might expect, I mean, Burke is no stranger to all aspects of the social order. It's an Irishman who's made it, you know, particularly with a Catholic mother and a Catholic wife in London, in Britain. So what his view is, broadly speaking, that the social order creates the conditions within which people can be successful and flourish. Now, it is true that if you take a snapshot of the social order, you can say, well, hold on a second, it looks like the aristocrats are doing terribly well and the folks at the bottom are doing terribly badly. And, of course, that's a correct criticism. It ignores the aspect that the aristocrats, from Burke's point of view, as you recall, are merely there to anchor the process and are under tremendous obligations themselves. There's no unaccountable power from that side. How would he have felt in 1832? I think actually he would have welcomed 1832.
Because your argument is that if it happens gradually and is sort of integral to society, talking to itself and coming to an arrangement, then he would have been okay with social change.
Yes. Well, Burke, I mean, Burke's conservatism, and of course it's not called conservatism until later, but that is what it is a philosophy of change. Yeah, I mean, Burke says, you know, a state without a means of change is without the means of its own preservation. So what he objects to, and he's one of the earliest great theorists of revolution, what he objects to is the total overturning. But things short of that, things that preserve and enhance a way of life, even at the cost of rebellion, as in the case of the colonists, he's comfortable with. It's the preservation of the way of life, and it's the damage done to what we would call social capital now that people tend to ignore when they make radical schemes of whatever kind. I think he would have welcomed. I mean, of course, it's a parlor game to suggest what people would welcome.
No, I know,
40 years after. But I don't think he would have. He would have been found that incompatible.
And there's numerous places we could take that. But just he emphasises property-owning democracy quite heavily, and again, that's clearly sort of only wouldn't allow through another class of people to vote and so on and so forth. Again, is that something that you think with time he might have put to one side?
Well, I think he thinks the point about property is that it secures rights and freedoms against a sovereign that might seek to take those away from you. Mm-hmm. And so a property becomes the anchor of rights well beyond merely the rights of the property class themselves. And I don't think he would have been, you know, he absolutely wanted a system in which people were able to succeed in their own terms wherever they came. And he says at one point, he says, if I were forced to take my place, I would take it with the weak, the meek and the poor and the humble.
Right, okay.
So I think he's much, much more nuanced than people currently understand. And he's absolutely not some idiotic dyed-in-the-wool reactionary, quite the opposite.
No. I'm going to ask my mother-in-law's question, and she's in her own way a very learned historian, which is, how could he write the words he wrote about Marie Antoinette?
He says, it is now 16 or 17 years since I saw the Queen of France at Versailles, and surely never lighted on this orb which she hardly seemed to touch a more delightful vision. Little did I dream that I should have lived to see disasters fallen on her in a nation of gallant men, in a nation of men of honour and cavaliers. I thought 10,000 swords must have leapt from their scabbards to avenge even a look that threatened her with an insult. But the age of chivalry is gone. That of sophisters, economists and calculators has succeeded, and the glory of Europe is extinguished forever. I mean, what is so magnificent about that is two things. One is its preposterous over-the-topness, which I've no doubt he would have been aware at the time, but also how many things are actually going on under the surface of that. So that is the pamphleteer's appeal to a certain kind of royalist sentiment, but it is also a thinly coded attack on the rationalist aspirations of the revolutionaries. And I do not share the view that, I mean, Burke, of course, was pushed into the position of supporting the monarchy, which was, of course, in the case of Louis XVI, rather a reforming monarchy. People forget this at the time. But I don't think that Burke's position in a sort of modern context would be one that celebrated the monarchy at any price. Quite the opposite. The whole point of the 1688 revolution was that it was the limited change that was preserved the integrity of the whole constitutional arrangement. Mm. And so I think what he's really seeking to do is to restore the social order rather than to restore the monarchy as such.
Just to pick you up on something you said just then about I think you were alluding to the possibility at one stage of a constitutional monarchy being successfully installed in France. Mm. And I suppose that's, for some people, the difficulty with Burke is that he's so quick to say this is going to be a disaster and indeed becomes a soothsayer of uncanny accuracy. Mm. But that actually for 2 to 3 years, and I absolutely understand that lying in the kind of early bit of the revolution is its end, but equally it nearly worked, didn't it? It was nearly a constitutional monarchy. Tom Paine did not want Marie Antoinette's head to be chopped off. You know, there were people who Burke set his face against very early on who eventually would come to have a fairly similar position to him.
Well, of course, Paine had been a friend of Burke's.
Yeah.
Paine, when he'd come to London, Paine was from East Anglia, and when he came to London after the American Revolutionary War, for whom Burke was regarded as a hero in America, was close to Burke. And indeed, Burke said that he said, we hunt in pairs. But Paine was a deeply dishonest man. Who never retained the affection or admiration of anyone who knew him for any period of time.
And died a deeply lonely death.
Including George Washington. And what was interesting about Paine, of course, was that Paine then fought a very vindictive campaign against Burke, suggesting that he was receiving a secret pension, a fact for which there was no evidence, and indeed entirely untrue as far as we know. So I don't think Paine deserves any great moral high ground, although he is undoubtedly a brilliant journalist. No, I think in Burke's case, there is a kind of nobility of endeavour, despite failure, which wholly outshines Paine. And there's a depth of thought which outshines Paine. And I'll have that argument.
I'm going to ask you one 2013 question, because the time is galloping away from us, which is up when you had your four principles. You talked about representative Parliament and this idea that you're not sent to Parliament to do the bidding of Bristol or Old Sarum or wherever. And yet, with the recent gay marriage debate, you saw many, many, many MPs on programmes like mine saying, hold on a second, my people didn't put me in Parliament to put this through. Do you think that the principles are coming slightly unstuck?
Well, I think we've got a lot of people who... we've got a society which doesn't really understand the nature of the British Constitution. I mean, that is the problem. I mean, for example, it's widely believed in this country that the British Constitution is one of popular sovereignty. It is not one of popular sovereignty. It is one of parliamentary sovereignty. It is one in which the popular vote acts as one part of a bicameral consideration in the legislature amounting to a relationship with the Queen and Parliament. And it's evolved over the years to balance popular legitimacy against expertise, to allow the short term and the aesthetic to be offset by the long term and the considered.
Yeah.
And as soon as one thinks of these things purely in terms of popular sovereignty, you're missing a lot of that. And I'm afraid I have colleagues across the House who, under pressure of political events and with Twitter at their backs, occasionally say things that they wouldn't necessarily support in a more considered moment.
Okay, well, we could go on, but let's open it up to questions. This gentleman here.
In the light of Burke's admirable statement that MPs are representatives rather than delegates, what do you think Burke would have thought of the modern party whipping system?
Well, it's actually a topic I discuss in a little detail in the book. Burke, the part of the quotation, the famous quotation that no one remembers, is the point where he says that nor must MPs be, as it were, the lickspittles of Westminster. That's not his terminology, but that is the thought. So he's looking for a kind of constrained independence that gives that, as it were, vitality and energy to the system. So I don't think he would have been in favour of very, very heavy use of the whip, or of MPs who kowtowed to heavy use of the whip. But the reason why the whip is so important, and people forget this now, is the reason why it was important at the time, which is the alternative is faction. And faction means, it's rather like proportional representation. You get changes in government without a popular vote. You know, little groups move over to one side of the house. No one's actually voted any differently. There wasn't a general election, and yet you've got a change of government. And this happens repeatedly in the 1760s. So, and the trouble with faction is that faction is really ultimately based on interest, and often self-interest, whereas political parties are based on principle. They do not dissolve after they lose power. They stay united. That principle has to be articulated in order to be shared. It therefore must be public. And therefore you get this will come as a surprise to some people, but you get a more honest politics. Although we don't feel that politics is very honest at the moment, the whip has many recommendations as well as some drawbacks.
Yes, thank you. Coming back to your high-minded principles that Burke outlined some years ago, with the view that perhaps politicians in the current age are constantly scrutinised by the press, indeed they're constantly scrutinised by the proletariat through social media, how well do you think modern politicians stand up to those principles?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think sometimes they stand up very well indeed, actually. You know, whatever you think about a Churchill or a Thatcher, these were not people. I mean, in Churchill's case, as you know, he was not a man of, you know, he had rather racy set of friends that he hung out with. He wasn't averse to going on 3 month holidays and parliamentary time. You know, he wouldn't have survived Twitter very long. On the other hand, we wouldn't have been in a very good place in 1940 if we hadn't had him. You know, I think the politician who can survive public inquiry of that level is very rare indeed. One person who does, and who I argue in the book is really the archetype of a great leader, not quite a modern leader, is Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln is absolutely extraordinary, and rather, he's one of those people who, the more you know about him, the more you admire. And he was a devoted follower of Tom Paine, but actually acts in a completely Burkean way. He is extraordinarily restrained during the Civil War. He is extremely careful not to alienate the swing states that might become supporters of the South. He is extremely protective of the rule of law, with the glaring exception of habeas corpus, for reasons of state, all the way through. And he manages to kind of coax and love the country in all its parts to a point where it's able to reach not merely a victory in the war, but also the 13th Amendment and you know, the freeing of the slaves. So I think he stands up extraordinarily well.
He, of course, did receive whopping, great, big, massive endorsement from the Prime Minister with this constant throwaway, little platoons, this is what I believe, this is my ideology. Mm. Have you ever spoken to the Prime Minister about Burke and about sort of the strength, the feeling he has about that? I won't tease you about Big Society being dropped.
I'm happy to tease as much as you'd like, Allegra, on the Big Society. I think the Big Society has not been dropped. I think it's waiting to pounce. And the government is rightly allowing its actions to do the talking, and then it will fit the theory to the actions after that's happened. And I think the Big Society is actually a philosophy of government. I don't think it's a wheeze about philanthropy or volunteering. I think the question you raise, I hadn't understood the point of it, and I'm sorry about that. It's very interesting. I mean, Burke is not a soundbite politician. You cannot do Burke in 140 characters. And that's one reason why I absolutely love him to bits. And I think one of the things that's so sad at the moment, and one of the reasons why the RSA is such an extraordinary institution, is because there is a colossal hunger for an intelligent debate, an intelligent argument that doesn't pretend these differences don't exist, that doesn't ignore complexity, that actually engages with itself. I think people are desperate for that, and they don't get it at the moment in a lot of politics, and I wish they did. And one of the things that Burke does is he doesn't merely refuse to patronise his audience. And of course, he's a man who, you know, breaks new ground in political communication by publishing his own speeches. I mean, there's a moment, Burke's sitting on the back benches, one of the most famous people in the world, forget, you know, Europe, at the time. And so he never patronises his audience. He never talks down. Whoever, you know, and of course he's got a very elite audience, but he would never now, I think, patronise the audience. He always expects people to be able to follow. And actually, if you look at a Bill Clinton, whatever you think of Clinton, you know, Clinton does this thing where he'll give a speech and he's perfectly happy to get to paragraph 3, subsection 4, little 2, okay, but he always brings it back to his main argument. And people love that. Yeah. Because they're going somewhere, they're following him somewhere, they're believing, they're accepting, and then they'll come back and buy the whole thing. And one of the most frightening statistics in modern politics, I think, is the fact that in the 1960s, the average length of a political soundbite was 49 seconds. Now it's about 8.
Yeah. This gentleman here.
Considering the sort of the continually pervasive power of the media in politics today, do you think Burke would have seen that as beneficial to his own career, or do you think he would have been resentful to the media having such strong presence in politics?
Well, I don't think Burke would worry about the accountability particularly, but he would worry about the mob instinct. You have to remember that Burke's view is that circumstances, it is his word, circumstances give to political principle, every political principle, its distinguishing colour and discriminating effect. So you cannot divorce a principle from its context and then just bandy it around like some after-dinner conversation. You cannot just take a word like freedom or something we would consider, a particular freedom like habeas corpus, you know, a right like that, and just say, well, actually, we're going to pretend it's like, you know, that not the 9 o'clock news sketch, which has, you know, liberty, equality, cupcakes. You know, it's nonsense. And he's got a very good line, which I always think of in context of modern politics. Sometimes, which worries me when he describes Lord North, you know, is in the process of making a spectacular hash of the Revolutionary War. And he said, Lord North is a man who consults his invention and rejects his experience. And I rather fear that's what's happening now. And by the way, in the French Revolution, one of the great worries about the French Revolution is that because the mobocracy has taken over, these words like liberté, fraternité, égalité have become traded in that way. They've just become slogans.
Jesse, when you said you're worried that's what's happening now, with regard to what?
Well, I just think that you can't govern by slogan. You have to have make an argument. You must make an argument.
They're not really doing that at the moment.
That's an attempt to lure me into indiscretion, Allegra Richardson.
No.
I'm afraid I'm going to quietly shifty
yeah,
past.
No, sure.
I would say that at all.
There is a paucity in these speeches are from Blair onwards. They were kind of verbless, weren't they?
Verbless speeches. I like verbs because they connote action.
I'm just wondering, there are conservative elements, obviously, in Burke's thought, the idea that you change in order to preserve, but there are also progressive elements in his thought. How does a modern conservative thinker, looking at someone like Burke, square the circle there between the very conservative elements of his thought, his reaction to the revolution, and the very progressive elements of his thought in his reaction to, well, other revolutions like the American Revolution? How do we think about that?
Well, of course, I deny that there is a contrast between the conservative and the progressive. Burke's whole life is animated, across all these five campaigns, great themes, is motivated by one great driving passion, which is detestation of the abuse of power and of arbitrary power. It is, I think, a great mistake. I'm not sure it's one you're committing, sir, but it's a great mistake in general for people to think, well, there's a progressive Burke who's kind of a goodie, and then there's a reactionary Burke who's a baddie. And I just think that's nonsense. The reason why Burke opposes the French Revolution is because he can see that the tyranny of a mob is going to lead to disaster. When he allegedly in his progressive phase earlier on, of course, he's acting from profoundly conservative principles almost all the way through. It's only because we've got some idiotic worry about the word conservative that we don't allow the possibility that it could be noble, honourable, good, wise, and conservative.
OK, we're going to have one last question and then we have to wrap it up.
I've been a long and almost passionate fan of Burke in lots of ways, but have struggled enormously with this notion of government, the business of government, being effectively the preserve of an elite, a social elite, a certain class were capable of governing on, how should we say, not so much on behalf of everybody else, but it is for that elite to do it. Government isn't the business of the man in the street, as it were. Looking at the contemporary context, where this is a criticism that's levelled time and again at contemporary politics, too many professional politicians, not a broad enough experience outside, what lessons would you say that we can learn today from Burke's view? In other words, are we again in a world in which politics is fundamentally an elitist game, or is it a populist game in which all of us have a legitimate right to participate?
Of course, politics in Burke's lifetime was an elite activity. There's no doubting that. If you want to play in the game of politics in Burke's lifetime, it's an elite activity. But there are aspects of Burke's thought which are not compatible with it being, as it were, simply regarded as an elite activity now. Of course, he does demand that people should be, able to give and exchange reasons. Good government relies on publicly enunciated principles. You have to have high levels of education in order to do that. But we have higher levels of education in this country that are vastly higher than anything could have been contemplated across the entire polity at that time. And I don't think for a second that Burke would have sought to exclude people, certainly on the basis of social class or background. This is an Irishman, for crying out loud. He's made his way to the centre of British politics, on the back of his individual genius. It is an exemplar of the kind of social mobility that I think he would seek to celebrate. And he's a man who never made it into the cabinet, probably in part because he was an Irishman and everyone else in there, broadly speaking, was a landed aristocrat. So no one could be more acutely aware and ultimately, I think, opposed to the concerns that you describe. Is British politics now an elite activity? Well, the answer is it absolutely shouldn't be. It should be properly involving of every aspect, and this is what a Burkean conception of the social order, in which everyone plays their role, would permit. Unfortunately, what you have is a foreshortened style of public debate, which has the effect of alienating people who've views that are not within that cadre. You have a feeling of the political class that extends between the journalists and the politicians. You have a very narrow base of political experience when people come in, and that isn't very attractive. And it also means that Parliament, which ought to be an exchange of views, a parleying between people with wildly different expertise and experience, becomes narrowed, technocratic, and allegedly, but not in fact, very expert. And it would be good to change that.
On that idea, there's that very moving quote from him about when his son dies, and it becomes obviously there's emotional feeling, but it's also quite political, because he has all these aristocrats around him who he feels are like a massive forest, and they just keep on producing, and they will go on and on and on, whereas his son is felled. His son becomes an MP, doesn't he? And that has a sort of political feeling for him, doesn't it? You read it.
It's a perfect point to end. I'm very grateful to you. Burke leaves Parliament and is absolutely thrilled when his son is given by Fitzwilliam, who's the son of Rockingham, the same pocket borough that he had had. And the moment is destroyed for him when the boy suddenly and unexpectedly dies. And it's not just a personal disaster for Burke, who's a very loving father and a loving husband, but it is also the kind of extirpation. He has a son who's already died, a younger son, and it is the extirpation of a line and a kind of his own, almost a dynastic ambition for an Irishman to make it in his own family in Britain. And so when he gets into a punch-up with the Duke of Bedford, who's Bedfordshire ox we saw earlier, and who is a dandled aristocrat of the most insubstantial and irresponsible kind, he doesn't hesitate to reach for his 12 bore in contrasting the young Bedford with his own experience. He says, "Had it pleased God to continue in me the hopes of succession, I should have been a sort of founder of a family. I should have left a son who, in all the points in which personal merit can be viewed, in science, in erudition, in genius, in taste, in honour, in generosity, in humanity, in every liberal sentiment, and every liberal accomplishment, would not have shown himself inferior to the Duke of Bedford or to any of those whom he traces in his line. But I live in an inverted order. They who ought to have succeeded me are gone before. They who should have been to me as posterity are in the place of ancestors." And then he says elsewhere, he says, "The storm has gone over me, and I lie like one of those old oaks which the late hurricane has scattered about me. I'm stripped of all my honours, I'm torn up by the roots, and lie prostrate on the earth." Lacking in proper public honours, Burke's life may have been, but his achievement is one of inextinguishable glory.
Jesse Norman, UK Conservative parliamentarian and author of Edmund Burke, Philosopher, Politician, Prophet, published in Australia by HarperCollins. Video of the discussion in full is available courtesy of the RSA. We'll post the link on the Big Ideas homepage. You can find us at abc.net.au/radionational.